Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall.
I don't know. I'm not ready.
You don't need to type it out. I'm okay. It's already recording.
Okay. Yeah, but I have no idea what you're going to say. It's going to be wrong. Okay. Do it.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today, we're going to go through our intro like always. Alex is going to worry that I'm going to say something inappropriate now.
That's what editing is for.
We're going to do... Alex, you're not supposed to talk during these. We've had this conversation before. It's three times now. Okay. Back on track. Then we're going to have a look back at the last chapter pack's meta, after which we're going to have a review of the new chapter pack and finally some closing comments. God, I killed that shit.
He forgot the tip of the week.
And Alex is going to have a tip of the week.
Episode 9. Happy Easter, John. How was your Easter weekend?
I was in bed for 4 days straight so far. The first two I couldn't get out. The next two I got slightly better. So I've been a little sick.
Yeah, I've thrown a bit of a wrench in some of our recording, but thankfully we had some guests show up last minute to help compensate. Although some people were improvising a little bit with their audio equipment. But turned out fairly well. Turns out we don't need you, John.
Well, there was one good thing about me being sick. You notice my voice is kind of raspy.
I noticed your voice is kind of raspy.
Have you heard me sing recently, Alex? Because with this raspy voice, it's damn sexy.
I see.
Sexy raspy.
Is it a Leonard Cohen sort of sexy?
Well, here, give it a listen. All right. Smelly cat. What are they feeding you, smelly cat? It's not your fault. They won't take you to the vet. You're obviously not their favorite pet. You may not be a bed of roses. You're no friends to those with noses. I promise you, before we're done, all the world will smell as one.
Well, John, I'm impressed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the best song I'll ever be able to do.
I remember thinking that the very last episode of last season, I should have sung the Irish song Parting Glass as a farewell to first edition.
But I heard you can actually sing.
You heard wrong, but that's okay.
Oh, that's good.
Figured I could put enough post-production that it wouldn't sound horrendous, but I'm going to leave yours untouched for our listeners.
That's a treat for them. I mean, I don't have this voice all the time.
All right. So do you keep an eye on any Thrones news prior to you being destroyed by whatever?
You know what? I have no idea what went on for the last 5 days, in all honesty.
You went down and on the third day you rose again. Wonderful. Well, what did we have? We had Wolves of the North was confirmed by the Canadian distributor to be arriving on April 7th. Now, we had previously mentioned that this was likely, but we actually have it in print rather than hearsay. We got Canadian regional dates.
Yeah, I saw those.
You don't sound enthused.
Well, one, there's no Canadian regional in Ottawa or Gatineau, which
True.
Is massively depressing because we have decent metas. Two, the Montreal one is like just before Gen Con, which I'm sure they asked for because I know a lot of them aren't actually going to make Gen Con. They're going to try to make American Nationals instead. But, you know, that makes it tougher for me. I'm still going to go. But the other regionals that are close to me, which is Rochester, New York, and Toronto now, and I say close, I mean a six-hour drive there and a six-hour drive back in both cases, are basically on either weekend of the 1 week where I travel for work. So it's going to
be... So they didn't consult you. This is a problem. Lion Rampant should consult you.
Am I supposed to look at Lion Rampant and be excited about things I can't go to?
Well, I personally, I think that at least it shows an understanding of Canadian geography. they've tried to sort of place one within a sort of 3-hour drive for most people, which I think is reasonable. I can understand why Montreal got one and not, for instance, Ottawa, if it was a decision between the two. Given that Toronto also did, and Fredericton was the next one over, it sort of made sense for the way they collected. And as far as I can tell, with the possible exception of the choice in BC, because I haven't heard much from that specific meta, they have been placed in cities that have metas.
That's better than last year.
Exactly.
I'll agree to that.
And yeah, I'll definitely be attending the one in Montreal. The one in Fredericton and the one in Toronto are going to be a little tricky for me because I'm doing a lot of traveling this year as well. Which, speaking of which, if there happens to be a meta in Israel, let me know. I'd love to meet up with you guys. I'm there for a week in end of May. And I'm trying to make sure that at least all my conferences, I get to meet and play Thrones with somebody at the other end. So I just don't know of an Israeli meta yet. Let me know if there is one.
Oh, I'm sure there's an Israeli meta.
What else? We got a fair few spoilers from the Wolves of the North box this week through a couple of channels. I don't think we'll talk about them specifically if you haven't had a chance to look at them, but Dennis from A Meager Contribution, our guest last week, spoiled two cards. Rob St. John's.
A ton of content, by the way. Dennis is a machine.
He's going to burn out. It's great. It's good content, but
good content and lots of it.
But he also has some people working from Florida, from the Florida meta, doing an AMC South, and so maybe they can pace themselves and not burn out, because it's looking really good. Rob St. John's also got two spoilers as well, a Polish podcast called Little Birds that I didn't even know existed, also got some spoilers. So check those places out. The reason these people have spoilers is that FFG gives them out. We've been offered them on occasion, well, regularly, but we've been turning them down recently so that more of these other sources, these brand new ones, can get, or not brand new in all of these cases, can get a little more traction. So check them out and see what content you like. And as we mentioned last week, definitely leave them feedback if you like what you see.
Yeah, I hear our listeners are mad about that, by the way, us turning down the spoilers all the time.
We haven't turned out all of them. I mean, when we got Nate on and we said, you know, it'd be really nice to have some Wolves spoilers, and we got them, and I think that's special. I think that's the right way to do things. I know it sounds kind of, I don't know, condescending might be the wrong word as well, but we have the listenership already. People know we exist. And if they don't like us, they're not listening to us already. So to get some of these new faces, you know, more recognition, to drive traffic to them, so that people can decide whether or not they like them, I think it's more important for those guests to have it.
I agree. I think we just also have to listen to our listeners.
The No Middle Grounds chapter pack came out this week. I have not yet got my hands on it, but I did play against it in my games night this week.
What was that?
Well, I lost a Stannis to a Crown of Gold on a Fire of Blood turn, which sort of really messed with me. Threw me off. I wasn't expecting that to be possible in that game, and I thought I had a lock on it, and I just got eaten alive after that. Just put me on tilt. But you know, I still haven't actually played with or against
people
for Snowwinter. So
people drew their one freaking Crown of Gold, which they had before they played the plot.
I dug for a Stannis and tripped him, and then he just disappeared.
I dug for him and then tripped him. You weren't digging too hard if you already had two of them.
I had one in hand, but I needed backup because I was... Anyway, details of minor games. But one thing I did sort of want to mention is that there was a ton of traffic on the No Middle Grounds chapter pack review on CardGameDB. You know, 62 comments at time of recording, which is great. And it's certainly showing that people are reading it and engaging with it and criticizing it, which I think is all fine. But I think it's important to also keep in mind that these people are putting their time and effort into these, and they're fine with being wrong, but, you know, point out why you disagree with them and not why they're idiots. There's a big difference between the two.
Whoa. People are pointing out why they're idiots?
No, but it sounds sort of like that's what they mean.
I have to totally go read this now.
But yeah, my games night, speaking of that, was actually quite remarkable and worth a little bit of mention. This week I had 6 new players from my lab or labs nearby come by, and one additional new player on top of that. And so I sort of prepared for it. I've revamped my demo decks. I'm going to give them one more week of testing and field testing, and then I'll post them, of course, as well to introduce people to the game. But it was just honestly, it was too much. Six players is a little too much for me to sort of supervise the games and teach and so on. But it was fantastic, the crowd that we had. It was our biggest night yet. You know, for a meta that didn't exist, we were at 15 people that night. So I'm really, really pumped about that.
Do you think you hooked any?
I think I hooked at least two of the six new guys. And we'll see.
Croc is strong.
Exactly. It's really easy to sell people on it when they feel the theme coming through that much. Because that was the sort of hook that I'd mentioned was the theme. And it really works when
people... And the show's coming back soon. And...
On the competitive end, it was actually... It's the last week... Or it was the last weekend of store championships. And it was a fairly slow one. There seemed to be a couple of 6 to 9 player store championships. I know of one or two 16, 23 mans that will be in the annals sometime this week. But really, it seemed like there's this little pause. Barely any pause, though, because next week is the first set of regionals.
I'm so glad store championships are done.
Why are you glad store championships are done? How many did you attend? One.
Exactly.
You've just been waiting for them to be done since you attended yours?
I've been waiting for them to be done since they started. I don't enjoy store championships because when store championships are done, regionals start. And regionals I care about much more.
I think store championships are a bigger part of growing the game than regionals are.
Sure. But for a person like me who has limited ability to travel and go to events now, it's nicer to plan for these bigger regional events than these small store championships that are out there. I like the more competitive play. If I can make time to do it, and I'm going to put time aside for my life, then I want to make sure I'm going to the most competitive environment that I can. And a regional is that compared to a store championship, where I would tend to take, because like you said, they're actually more important to, teach the game to new players, grow the game. I wouldn't want to bring a T1 and crush people's souls. Regionals, I don't feel bad doing that. So if I go to a regional and I beat Aaron again, then that's okay.
You're going to be crushing souls this regional season, John?
I just told you I couldn't go to any. I'm actually going to try to make as many.
So you're really excited for the regional season because you can live vicariously through some people who can actually attend regionals?
Yes. I'll be going to New York on the 30th of April for sure for their event.
That'll be quite the event, yeah.
So that's going to be a really big, probably bigger than most regionals, I would guess. They usually they had close to 50 people last time. I could see that happening again for this event. It'll be very competitive. That meta is a competitive meta, so I think that'll be a really fun trip.
Have you seen the dragon eggs that they're giving out as prizes as well?
I have. It's gorgeous.
You got to bring them home for your Danny.
Yeah, I mean, it's a competitive meta. I'll try to top. Try to make the cut. How about that? That's my
try to make the cut.
One thing at a time.
And when your daughter comes and goes, where are my dragon eggs, Dad? What will you tell her?
And she did want them, so now I'm playing for her. So you know it's going to be real. So when I lose, people can really make fun of me.
Okay. However, in this last week of store championships, I do want to mention that, I mean, we talked at great length about intentional draws last week, and we got a lot of great comments, very reasoned comments, very well-reasoned comments. So I enjoyed that immensely. But those rules don't go into effect until April 2nd with regional season. And they're actually already causing some controversy. There was a set of intentional draws at a store championship this weekend.
What?
That also happened in the absence of the judge.
Why?
Well, why is possibly the first question, and the second is, what do you do? Like, I know what I would do, and I talked to the TO about it a little bit as well. But
you'd disqualify them, wouldn't you?
In that case, it depends on their intention, but no, I would probably force them to flip for it. And that would be their penalty.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, it's not legal, and it definitely can't happen in the absence of a judge. And there were other circumstances surrounding this as well. So,
hotel. Gossip.
No. The point isn't to blacklist things. It's just that, you know, this is a change in the rules, and people need to be aware of it. If you're going to be calling it, you know, if you're going to try to get an intentional draw, you have to do it by the book. Don't cut corners. Call a judge, then start talking about intentional draws. You don't want to put the judge in the position where they're going to make you very unhappy.
Very true. Alex will make you unhappy.
It's what I do best in life. And lastly, old staple of Thrones 1.0 is back. Aegot cards. People seem excited. I'm not.
Sorry, not excited at all.
There are great things about Aegot cards. It has all the CCG cards. I still go back to that It's the site that has the most reliable database of old cards. So there's a lot going for it. But the people who really like the front page, it was never really my thing. It, you know, you can't really have a discussion that then disappears from the front page and is almost impossible to find. And while the deck builder was great, I think we have sort of cemented around Thrones DB and stuff. So I don't know. I'm not this sure
is,
that it...
This is my big issue. I don't want to happen what kind of happened in the 1.0 where the community was split across multiple sites and I had to go to two or three sites to check the news or check people's postings. With it gone, sadly, it kind of forced us all to Card Game DB and Thrones DB for our deck building. And to me, that's perfect. We're all in one place. We're all talking. We're all sharing. We have a forum that works. We have a place to post our...
All in one place, topics. Except those on the Facebook group. And then the ones on...
Well, that's what I mean. We don't need another site. We have so many.
I think I agree. I think it would fragment things at this point. But, yeah. You know, you can get all your news from me, John. But you do anyway.
No. You and others.
Well, that's about all I have for news this week. I don't know if we expect anything drastic over regional season. I'm surprised there isn't a pre-regionals FAQ. Just for a few, I mean, I've been answering rules questions and there are some that come up often enough.
Oh,
and now that you're asking
them,
because people will be bored. Wait, John is asking me for rules. What? Who are you and what have you done with John?
I've been really sick, but before regionals, some key rules.
No, I just mean the rules forum on Card Game DB, where I maintain a list, an FAQ list of questions that come up all the time. And I continue to maintain that, and I've actually had some other contributors help with the unofficial FAQ. So make sure to check that out. I've also, forwarded these
You want FFG to take your unofficial FFQ and publish it for everyone as official.
Yeah, that would do nicely.
This is a self-fulfilling prophecy that Alex has tried to put in motion here.
It'll be great. It'll retroactively prove me right on all the things I wasn't sure about, but pretended I was.
Yeah. You cannot control me, man. I know your tricks. I know your tricks.
So we are joined once again for this Black Iron Link segment by Paul, who is the creator and curator of the Iron Link database, and myself, Istril, the creator and curator of the annals. And I thought what we would do is maybe once again sort of summarize what the last chapter pack did to the meta, what the meta looked like for the King's Peace.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely great. And just a quick note before we get started, I changed a couple things with the Iron Link, including adding a new score feature that I'll probably be referencing throughout this. And all score is the number of wins a faction or agenda or faction/agenda have multiplied by their win percentage squared. So the idea is that it gives an idea of both how often you see the deck and how much it's winning.
This was to avoid what we had last time. It happens in the annals as well, like Banner of the Kraken being a 1.6 qualification ratio because three people had made the cut with it.
That's exactly the purpose, yeah.
So I guess what would be what you picked out as maybe the top three trends of the King's Peace meta?
By far, the biggest thing is anything associated with Lannister is double.
Wow. Yeah. The Annals have certainly picked this up. I mean, the King's Peace meta, we had about a third of decks winning were Lannister. It wasn't that bad in the cut. They're not the most overrepresented in the cut. In fact, that's Tarik by a very wide margin that is doing amazingly well in representing in the cut. But Lannister has reached about the popularity in the field that it reaches in the cut. It just happens to have won a lot of those tournaments, which I think once you're down to the winners' numbers, those don't necessarily mean as much. They're just much smaller numbers.
And Baratheon actually still has a slightly higher win percentage. They're at 57%, whereas Lannister's at 56. So it's a lot of that is just in terms of their sheer popularity.
Now, you said anything associated with Lannister. Did you also mean Banner of the Line?
I didn't. Okay. Perhaps I...
No, I'm curious because that's actually probably the most remarkable trend for me is that we talked about this last time, that Banner of the Line was sort of fading as Lannister was gaining popularity, but the annals are showing that Lannister has reached roughly its popularity, and it's Banner of the Lion that's picking up. and went from 10% of the field in to 18% of the cut. So it's a 1.8 qualification ratio, practically, which is insane. Way above every other agenda. So not only should you either play Lannister and have a fairly decent qualification ratio, or I think most of the rest is Targ Lion that is just doing amazingly well right now.
In terms of its overall score, still, it's actually a lot lower than it was back in Taking the Black when Banner of the Lion was all over the place. It took a big jump down at Road to Winterfell, and then it's working its way back up. But
okay, yeah, I'd certainly seen that dive in Road to Winterfell. What surprised me was just how quickly it has bounced to become a very important part of the field. I mean, assuming that we're not seeing Lannister Banner of the Lion, and I really hope we're not, we're still talking about 45% of the field being either Lannister or Banner of the Lion, which is a little bit alarming.
Yeah, for me, Lannister as a house or Banner of the Lion as a agenda make up about 28% of all the games out there.
So not quite as bad in casual games.
Correct.
All right. Well, what would you say another great trend is? I suspect that most people are very interested in finding out how the new agenda is doing.
Yeah, I think it's doing very well. Your prediction that it would drag down the rate of fealty last time we talked is seeming to bear true in my numbers. It's the third highest in terms of overall score. In terms of win percentage, it's right at 52%, so nothing super spectacular, but very respectable.
Yeah, I'm really happy with what it's done overall. It seems to have been played out of factions, many factions that weren't particularly popular with the exception of Lannister. So we are seeing some Tyrell and some Martell climbing because of it. And it's a brand new agenda, and we couldn't really predict where it was going to be. And right now it's pretty much an even qualification ratio. It's 14% of the field, 16% of the cut, 14% of winners, which is a great place for a new agenda to be. It means that I think they've done it surprisingly well, and I'm impressed.
Yeah, and it's a fun agenda. I personally, even in non-competitive decks, it's one that I sort of lean towards because it's interesting and it makes sure you play in all phases of the challenges game.
And is there anything else that drastically changed this meta that you think is worth calling attention to?
Banner of the Sun, in terms of the banners that made the biggest jump, they jumped up a lot, which we were talking about last time, how we were expecting that and they were doing well. Their win percentage is still 53%, which is good. It's not bad by any means, but the popularity of it has really increased. Now essentially tied with Lannister in terms of popularity at 14%.
I guess that's not that different from my stats once I start getting... I mean, currently Sun is more popular than Lion in the fields, but less popular in the cut because Lion is so severely overrepresented. Do you have any picks for the duds? The ones that really aren't performing or really aren't showing up right now?
Banner of the Stag is down at 41 win percent.
Interesting. Banner of the Stag is actually the lowest as well in the annals.
In terms of the houses, you have to get out a magnifying glass to find Night Watch on the score sheet because they're the least popular faction, making up about 9% of all the games, and they're winning the least with only 35% win rate. And those two things together do not give you a high score.
They've actually been performing fairly well in the last 2 weeks, and they were actually up at a qualification ratio of 0.9 at one point in the last 2 weeks, and they've dropped a little bit since then, with a Night's Watch fealty deck that has been making the rounds after going 9-0 in Europe, and that more people have played. I still wouldn't, you know, pick Night's Watch to win any major tournaments. It's still the least popular faction by about half, again, below Martell as the main faction. But it's been doing slightly better. I would be tempted to say that aside from the fact that Targ is significantly overrepresenting, the field is almost reaching the point in the King's Peace where all of the factions are close to a qualification ratio of one. That is to say that they're being played almost as often as they are expected to based on their success rates. And it has dropped in the last 2 days or so with his last weekend of tournaments where Stark did very badly in France, where it was normally doing fairly well. But before I entered those this weekend, I think all of the qualification ratios were either between 0.8 and 1.2 for every house except Targ, which was above that. To see all the houses be played pretty close to their potential right now, right on the verge of a big shakeup, sounds quite interesting to me. It sounds like we were reaching an equilibrium and it was time to destabilize it.
Yeah, no, I think I sort of use a 5% and a 10% test where if you're within 45 to 55% win rate, you're doing pretty good and that's balanced. If you're up to 60 or down to 40, it's becoming a little bit more questionable. And then if you're outside of that, you're either overpowered or just bad.
You're broken right. One way or the other.
And the only one that's broken one way or the other is Night Watch.
So any particular predictions for this this next? I mean, it'll be tricky because we have both Wolves of the North coming out on April 7th. And by the time people are listening to this, No Middle Ground will have come out 4 days prior to this. Do you think that if we, by the time the next chapter pack comes out, there'll be something? Or is it just too many cards for it to stabilize to reach that kind of equilibrium again? And it's really anybody's guess.
I think it's going to be a very hectic next month. No Middle Ground by itself is going to do huge things with First Snow and whatever they renamed Threat from the North. Yes, Something of the Dragon. And then the box set looks like it should be as well.
I suspect Stark will have a surge in popularity. I don't know if that will be correlated with a surge in success at all. And I suspect that lots of people will stick with Lannister as a safe place to be in a First Snow meta. I'm not sure that it'll be the optimal place to be, but I think that we won't see any decrease in Lannister or Lyon's popularity, and we will see an increase in Stark's popularity. And to me, that'll mean that something's got to give, and I don't know what it'll be. There's not much room for Night's Watch to give, though. I think First Snow doesn't help them at all.
I suspect you will see a good showing from Stark. Maybe not in terms of qualification ratio, but in terms of winning, because I think they do gain a lot out of their box. I actually think that with the Stark box is going to be one of those examples where the Iron Link will lag behind because lots of people will be picking them up and trying them out, but not piloting it correctly initially, just because it's very different than what we currently have, which is going to drop Stark's overall win percentage, but then I think over time it will bounce back up because I think the cards in the box have some real power.
I will say if Stark is going to have a huge surge in popularity, I'm glad it is on the backs of cards that seem to have really good art in this box.
Yeah, so. No, I agree with that. And not everybody, but there's going to be a lot of very pretty Stark mats running around.
Well, that might segue us very nicely into our next topic, which is how would one living in, say, Michigan, to pick a place at random, manage to get one of those Stark playmats? How would someone get to
I have
that?
No idea, but I am hosting a regional at AFK Games in Holt, Michigan on April 9th. So it's going to be 2 days after the Stark box drops, which, as being the head judge there, scares me beyond measure.
The rules questions that may come up with new cards.
Yeah, having a box set that we know a lot of, but we're still missing probably about half of, and having to come up with rulings on the fly only to have you or K-Tom the next day tell me I was completely wrong and I ruined this person's regional.
No pressure at all.
So, no, I think it's going to be really exciting to see what people slot in.
Now, have you had a chance to talk to your store and make sure that they'll have enough of the box in stock? Because I know that might be an issue given it's 2 days after its release.
Yeah, I've talked to them and I've warned them. They're obviously not going to have 50 copies on hand, but they are going to order extras. And I am encouraging anybody to give them a call and have them pre-order one. If you're going to be picking it up at the store, talk to them ahead of time. If you're able to get it from your local store, do that. We're going to be one of the first, and we've got some cool promos that I actually just got in the mail today. First 50 people that pre-register by calling AFK will get a promo calling the banners with a really cool picture of Gregor with a small army behind him and three custom put to the swords.
These are the ones where someone is being put to the spear rather than put to the sword?
It may be being put to the spear.
I will see if I can link to the image that you've given for that. It is quite nice.
Thank you to the artists as well for donating that. I know you just did a big show on it, but the artists really make all of this alt art stuff possible.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us for this update, and I think we will reconvene as, what's the next one? Calm Over Westeros? Is that? No. Oh, no. I'm getting my chapter packs. In
no,
the
you're, that's
now.
Right. Calm Over Westeros.
Calm Over Westeros. I think we'll be coming at a time where the meta will be anything but calm, so maybe...
maybe it will
we'll,
give
we'll
some
see
calm.
What, maybe, yeah, it'll give us some time for the meta to settle down. And I look forward to seeing what has happened
cool. Then.
All right, so there's a new plot in the meta. Something that's scaring the bejesus out of Stark. And a lot of players. So I hear them crying about it. So this is what I suggest. If you want to learn how to play against that plot, next time you sit down across, you know, your friend that you play test with, or your loved one, or whoever it is, I want you to think every single time a plot's revealed that it could be first snow. And if it's worse for you that it's actually first snow, act like it is. And this will get you in the mindset on how to play around it and how to be prepared for it all the time. Face your fears.
I was going to add something, and I don't really have much to add. I mentioned in a either previous or after segment, because I don't know where this is going, probably previous, that it should be comparable to First Snow Winter. It should be a plot that you have in mind that it could always be the next plot. And it's comparable to March to the Wall.
No. First Snow Winter should be comparable to First Snow Winter.
Actually, it is, strangely enough, exactly comparable to First Snow Winter. But I mean March to the Wall. It's a very much a meta-defining plot. You're setting up, keeping it in mind. You're playing every round, keeping it in mind. And I think, yes, you should be treating First Snow Winter, at least until you get a hang for it, as if it was always going to be the next plot revealed. All right, so in this week's chapter pack review, which I was initially just going to call No Middle Ground because that's the chapter pack we're reviewing and I have no imagination, but I'm actually going to call this the Great Spring Sickness because John is sick. About half of the people I asked to come on are sick. Even one of our guests has mentioned that they've started to catch something from their kid. I personally am running a fever from Elena's own sicknesses. So I think 4 in every 10 of us will die as Thrones players. It is the beginning of the Great Spring Sickness. But joining me for this review, well, first of all, brand new to the show is Tomer from Massachusetts.
Hello.
What perspective will you be bringing and why are you here?
I'm here to bring the Nedley perspective, and I really hope that in the spring sickness, our current king won't die.
Next up, we have Tom all the way from Australia. What brings you here?
He's died already.
Oh, he's death.
This is bad.
So,
Sorry. I think because I'm doing it on my mobile, I just have to not let the home screen lock, otherwise it closes the browser on me. So I'll just.
Right. Perfect. So
I'm literally on top of it.
As I was saying, we are also joined by Australia, bringing us up to. Well, two continents for now, but three on the show. Tom, what perspective are you bringing to the chapter pack review?
Today I'm bringing the Jamie perspective. So basically...
So easy to confuse.
Yeah, I like to think I'm a competitive player. So, we'll go from that perspective. And so these are cards that should be featuring in competitive decks and...
Right, and you were a competitive player, at least for first edition, with a reasonable track record, right, Tom?
Yeah, so I got a trip to Worlds last year. I was the overall Australian champion. I was third in Joust and third in Melee at our Nationals last year. So a bit like you, Alex, I got the overall title, but I didn't actually win.
And last but not least, we are joined by the United Kingdom's representative, Keb.
Hello. You
stayed up very, very late for us. And what perspective will you be bringing today?
Well, I'm a Baratheon player, so I'm going to be bringing the Stannis perspective. The only thing I care about is seeing my family on the Iron Throne, and that is House Baratheon.
House Baratheon it is. And when did your affection for House Baratheon start? Because I remember you playing some in first edition, but I didn't know it was a...
Well, they're my favourite house in the books. And I did like them in first ed, but I tended to lean more towards Lannister just because I liked the Neil mechanic. And then when second ed came out and they put the Neil mechanic on Baratheon, I was like, hello. All of my dreams came true.
Splendid. And since we have a good rounding of players' perspectives, I'm free to go for the Maester perspective, where I'm going to talk about things that interest me mechanically more than anything else, sort of from a rules perspective. And without John to tell me how boring it is, I'm sure this will be very exciting. So how about we start off with the Nedley perspective? And Tomer, you can give us a first card from this chapter pack that really caught your eye?
Yeah, so I'm going to start with Sir Horace Redwine. If you remember, he, of course, joins his twin brother, Sir Hobber, from the previous chapter pack. Now, those two twins are, in the books, affectionately referred to as Horror and Slobber by Queen Cersei, who is obviously interested in them because they are some of Queen Margaery's suitors. And when Cersei is spying on them, she discusses them with one of the knights from the King's Guard, Sir Osmond, who tells her all about Margaery's suitors, and he says, "The Redwine twins come calling too. Slobber brings flower and fruit, and Horror's taken up the loot. To hear Osney tell it, you could make a sweeter sound strangling a cat." So I was particularly happy that they gave Sir Horace the loot, and every time I look at him, and especially the expression on his face, I imagine a cat being strangled.
He actually looks like a hobbit, I think, in the art, much like his brother.
Yeah, they're supposed to be quite homely, right?
Yeah.
In the books. But what I really like is the text on this feels really Nedley too, because he gets down on his knees and ladies get up and leave. All right, did Horace make anyone else's list?
I don't like him, obviously, because any stand is miserable for me.
Ah, so he made your list or he wasn't in your top three?
Oh, no, he wasn't in my top three, no.
Ah, okay. All right. So you don't like him because he stand things.
Apart from that, you know, obviously he's going to stand Margaery, who's then going to stand...
Randall?
Yeah. So he's really just standing Randall.
He's just standing Randall.
I actually think he's a lot for Daenerys, both of the Redwine twins. Very good with Targaryen.
Yeah.
I think it may even have been James who had said that Slobber was the best Targ card in the last pack.
Yeah.
I don't think this is the best Targ card in this pack, however.
No, it is not. No.
All right, so Keb, you want to give us one of Baratheon's most hated?
Most hated? Absolutely. And it will be Condemned.
Oh, I'm glad someone's bringing that one up. I wanted to talk about that. So what's so terrible about Condemned?
Well, you lose your power icon, don't you? And the power icon's the most important icon out of the three. That is basically the basis of my deck. I mean, I've got a red keep in there. You know, how can I initiate a power challenge with my beautiful red keep when they've taken away my icons? I absolutely have to be full disclosure here. First edition, I hated Martell with an absolute fiery rage. And this is doing very, very little to make me think any better of them.
From my perspective, this card's actually been panned a little bit in reviews, and I'm surprised. Of the three attachment icons, that we haven't seen the military one yet, but we imagine it's coming, I think this one's the scariest. I think that the intrigue one is really only good in combination with Tears of Lys, but I think this one is good basically all the time. I think you're lucky in Bera in that you have Crescent to deal with it, but...
Yes.
I think this creates big gaping holes, and I think that later on when we see things like Valor come back, if you can strip the one or two power icons they have on the board, it doesn't matter how much of a board presence they have after that.
Isn't there a card that makes every Meister into a Crescent, basically, at some point?
We have seen a spoiler for, I think, what looks like a Meister's Chain. I don't know if we've seen the full text yet.
Yeah, I thought it was Neil the Maester to remove a condition attachment.
I hope it's Neil the Chain. That would be slightly easier, but I hadn't seen the text yet. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, negative attachments that are not terminal are very annoying to deal with.
And was that card on anyone else's list? No, all right. So we're clear so far. All right, well, Tom, bring us back to the Jamie perspective.
The card that I'm going to pick is Wardens of the North. It's a plot card for Stark. Limit one per plot deck. It's 5 gold, 5 initiative, so both very good stats, very high. War trait, which I think is going to be a relevant, decent trait for Stark. It's also not a negative trait, and it seems to have the theme that Stark are getting, where it's like the old quote-unquote naval mechanic, where they can jump characters into challenges. I think it's going to be very powerful. It's just a good all-round plot, and probably the only negative is the 5 reserve, but I still don't think that's going to stop it from seeing play.
So what makes this a Jamie pick above all the other?
Well, I mean, I think if you're a competitive player, if you were looking at all these cards from a competitive basis, I think most of the cards that I sort of shortlisted could go into decks, but at the moment, this one almost seems like it might be a compulsory choice for most Stark decks.
I think that's fair. From my perspective, I really love the threat of activation that we're seeing in Stark so far, and it's my it may be my favorite faction now, which I would never have thought to say from the core. I just love those Kennel Masters, and I love Lady, and this is a card that does the same thing, so I'm really excited about it.
Well, I think as well, a lot of people would look at that 5 reserve and go, oh, you know, you might have to play it a bit later in the game, you know, when it's, when your hands thin out a little bit or whatever. But this plot is actually going to be a beast early in the game, where you're going to have to get people to overcommit to defense or save too many characters back from attacking you, because if you're going second, you know, you've got so much challenge manipulation, and I think it's going to just make triggering things like Put to the Sword, you know, almost at your will. So yeah, I think it's very good.
All right, well, I'll jump into my very first Maester card. This one is partly because it was one of my Maester cards in the first chapter pack review we did in this format, and this keys into that, and that is Paid Off, the attachment. It's a neat surprise, Neil. It's a flavorful card with, you know, money changing hands as someone's paid off. With Ambush, it can be very versatile because it's non-terminal, so the character can die and you could use it again that turn. But there are two things, and one we haven't really talked about in all of these negative attachments that say opponent's character only, which is clearly there to prevent you from setting it up on your own Chud just as an extra setup card, which I think is an interesting thing that they've done with design. That's the only thing I can think of as to why this is on so many of these, besides protection from like Plaza Punishment and stuff. And I find it interesting that they felt that the ability to set it up might make it too powerful, and they had to make it basically non-setup. So it makes it a kind of neat little event. But the second thing is obviously that interaction with the word give and the Brothel Madam. If you pay the gold for this, you also satisfy the requirements of the Brothel Madam. But if you're counting on being able to pay the gold for Paid Off and you're sitting on the gold, well, your opponent will just not trigger Paid Off and therefore not give you the opportunity. So mechanically, I don't know how often it's going to matter, but the fact that the wording is like that, I think is very interesting that we're going to see multiple mechanics that may tone down a little bit the power of that Brothel Madam we've been seeing so much.
What worries me is that Lannister has that location that lets him do 2 intrigue challenges per turn.
Yeah.
Casterly
Rock.
So be careful when you choose to stand the character, I guess.
They don't have to trigger it the second time to give you the chance to stand it. So either way, you're going to probably be knelt out unless you have 2 gold to pay it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just makes me a little bit sad to see Lannister getting Neil again. I thought we were done with that.
And so this one didn't make anyone else's list? We're 4 for 4 and we haven't intruded on anybody's yet?
Well, I was actually, this was on my list to discuss just because I was sort of annoyed that my mechanic was, no, I'm not really annoyed, but you know what I mean. It's interesting to see Lannister getting some Neil back. I think thematically it's quite nice, but it's quite frightening as well.
I think thematically Stannis is quite a jealous person as well, so that would have been a very good choice.
That's right. This is very meta.
All right. I'm all right with that then. Okay. Perfect. I hate that my thing is being shared. My toys.
All right, well, let's do round two then. Tomer, what do you got for us?
Okay, so for round two, I have a fan favorite. That's Hodor, whose flavor text is obviously Hodor, because that's the only thing Hodor says. However, if people who haven't read the books or haven't seen the show wonder, why is it that Hodor cannot be declared as an attacker unless you control Bran Stark? So I brought a little quote from the books, as I have for each of the cards. This is a slightly longer one, but it's from A Dance with Dragons. What happens when they are under attack? And Hodor, who is a very big guy, who's a simple guy, pretty big, is maybe able to defend himself, but not very good at responding. And so Bran, who is a warg in the books, which means he can control other creatures by kind of taking over their bodies, jumps into Hodor. And suddenly he was not Bran, the broken boy crawling through the snow. Suddenly he was Hodor, halfway down the hill, with the white raking at his eyes. Roaring, he came lurching to his feet, throwing the thing violently aside. It went to one knee, began to rise again. Bran ripped Hodor's longsword from his belt. Deep inside, he could hear poor Hodor whimpering still, but outside, he was 7 feet of fury with old iron in his hand. He raised the sword and brought it down upon the dead men, grunting as the blade sheared through wet wool and rusted mail and rotten leather, biting deep into the bone and flesh beneath. "Hodor!" he bellowed and slashed again. This time he took the white's head off at the neck, and for half a moment he exulted. So that's Bran controlling Hodor, and it's a very... I'm sure it's going to be a favorite card for any Stark player.
Yeah, it's basically a reprint-ish of a version that we had in first edition. And they've adapted it according to the cost curve and a few other things. It's not an ally now, but it was a great card then. And even though it's weaker now, it's still a great card. I also think it's really neat that we just talked about Wardens of the North. That would also allow Hodor to participate as an attacker, even though he wouldn't be declared as an attacker. So I think you can get a fair bit of mileage out of this card in Stark in general.
Yeah, and it's another unique Stark that can trigger Winterfell Castle and all the other tricks that Stark have. It's really a cool card. Very efficient.
I'm just looking at the art. Is it just me, or is he Andre the Giant?
He is definitely Andre the Giant from Princess Bride, yes.
Wow.
Fezzik. I think there's no doubt about it.
Anybody want a peanut?
I've got a rhyme with that, don't I? What's the rhyming game? Oh, Princess
Bride.
That is
the rhyme he gives. Stop it. I'm in it. Anybody want a peanut?
All right. Well, Keb, what is your next most hated card? I suppose they don't have to be hated. They could be bearer cards you like, but it's more fun to hate cards.
Well, this is what I hate. And unsurprisingly, we're back to Martell. The Maester of Starfall. What is that? So he can choose somebody to lose insight, intimidate, pillage, or renown. Two of those really upset me a great deal. One of those makes me slightly sad. One of them I'm kind of pleased about. Pillage is bad. But yeah, intimidate. Losing intimidate ruins my life, basically.
And losing renown completely stops you from using Lightbringer.
Yep. So I've already secretly taken these cards out of our binders and burned them. I suggest everyone else does the same. Cleanse them in the holy fire.
It's worth noting that he has to kneel to do this. So you do have a built-in counter there, Stannis.
That's very true. Oh,
yeah,
God.
He's a 3-gold monocon. He's susceptible to First Snow of Winter, which I suspect some Baratheon decks are going to run. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't think he's that big of a threat, even though he is most definitely annoying.
Yes, he's an irritation, I'd say.
I think the reason he sees some play is because Here to Serve, you're using it to fetch the unique in-house maester, but you want to have a backup target that isn't just a dupe to expand your board presence, so you're probably going to include this. I do think it's neat when you get to completely neuter a character like Euron by stripping the pillage, or, you know, if Stannis has renown from his sword, well, you at least get to prevent the stand. So sometimes it's more than just the effect from the keyword. I think it's really interesting that they deliberately chose not to list stealth there. That seems like a very conscious decision to say, nah, we don't want to be able to neuter that. That may slow down games too much or something. I don't know what went behind that decision. All right, so we still don't have any overlap. So, Tom, what do you have for this round?
The next card that I'm picking is Blood of the Dragon.
Yeah.
So, it's a Targaryen plot, loyal, 2 gold, 2 initiative, 1 claim. So nothing too exciting there. Plot limit 1, 5 reserves. So you're probably wondering, why is this any good? But, look, the effect. Each non-dragon character gets -1 strength and is killed if strength is 0. So we saw a plot like this back in first edition, and it was amazing then. Disclaimer, at the moment, I don't think this may see play in every single Targ deck, but it's going to be close. And in the future, any burn effect that gets printed for the rest of the game just makes this card even better.
I think this one also has a lot of interesting sort of rules interactions. It didn't quite make my list, but you know, if you flip this while your opponent's going to flip marched, it's going to get rid of the chud that they were hoping to march against your big target. If you flip this, then you can just drop Viserys for his cost. He dies instantly, but you still get his interrupt because it happens before he leaves play. So you can use Viserys as an attachment removal event in the marshalling phase. If your opponent has, you know, green blood traitors in hand because they bounce them back from First Snow Winter, well, they're not going to be able to play them this turn because they'll be dead before they could trigger. There's a lot of cards, you know, things like Bran that are a huge nuisance for Targ that are just gone with this. I think it is.
And it's killed.
And it's killed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the only catch is that, you know, Targ was running a draw plot normally, counting coppers as its 2 golder, and it's really tempted to switch to this one, but that probably is at the cost of some draw. So you've got to get card advantage when you play this plot. You've got to kill a character or two out of it, or you're in trouble. You can't just use it as a deterrent.
Yeah.
Yeah, as mainly a Targ player, I'm very excited about this. I think it really helps bring the Dracarys into the reach of some of the bigger characters. It's a big threat in a Targ versus Targ because you can kill Daenerys without having your own Daenerys out. It's really a cool card.
It's also interesting that, you know, when I first started playing, I may be slightly biased with a couple of these choices, but when I first started playing competitively, I picked up John Bruno's House of Pain deck, and this card was basically in it in another form, and then another card in this chapter pack was in that deck in another form. So I might be slightly skewed in my choices today.
Your early days, your formative years, you were...
I think we're going to mention House of Pain. We need to explain why it was called that. Because that is such a gloriously named deck. Possibly the best named deck of first edition.
Because jump around.
Ambush used to be Targaryen only in first edition. And it made full use of that. Things jumped around. It was great. It was glorious.
Well, it wasn't that glorious.
All that, and it did everything that you never want done to you in the game.
I think it's second only to my friend's deck. He had a deck. My friend Josh ran a Lannister deck that was called We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a little sore about House of Pain. It was my first loss in any tournament in Thrones ever. Was to John
Bruno
in round 2 of Worlds the year that he won. And that deck was designed to destroy my deck. It was not even remotely close. Not that I had stood a chance had our decks been even. I was severely outplayed, but still a little bit salty there with House of Pain.
Did you say it was John Bruno actually piloting it when you lost?
Yeah, the year he won Worlds with it. It was that was my first Thrones tournament ever. And
your first loss?
And my first loss.
There is no shame in that. That is amazing.
All right.
Just as a quick segue onto that deck. Yeah, like that deck, when I picked up as a pretty new player, I looked at a lot of cards in it. They just didn't make sense. But obviously knew it was a world championship winning deck. And this is why I really love how the community is getting behind posting winning deck lists, because when I first picked that deck up and started playing with it, I didn't know why the certain card choices were in there, but it was just so well designed and the synergy became apparent as I played the deck. It actually taught me a lot about, you know, how to play the game just by the deck being so well built that it literally, you know, as I draw the cards, it would be evolve as to what the strategy was supposed to be playing it. So, yeah, like for a formative experience in Thrones, I credit a lot of early success to basically picking up those well-constructed decks and just using them without even changing a card because, you know, someone else knew better when they built it.
All right.
Hear, hear.
So I'll move on to the second Maester pick. My pick here is Wraiths in Their Midst. And the reason for this, apart from the fact that I absolutely love the art, I had a good long look at the card, and then I started to see the Wraiths. Like at first in, just look at the card. You see the character, you see them holding that, you see the tree, and then you look in the background at these shapes, and then you realize that those are the Wraiths, and they're coming. I really like that. Big props to Thomas Jedrzejczyk, who in fact seems to do 90% of the art we mention. So I guess I know who I should get to do my champ card.
Wow, can we get that art there on a playmat? Because that's amazing.
It is. It's really well done. But what I find interesting about this from a mechanical standpoint are two things. First, we start to see some more reserve manipulation, which we'd really only seen a little bit of gain in Night's Watch and Alanis as a negative modifier. And this is brand new space for Thrones. So it really starts to ask questions. How valuable is just having more cards than your opponent, even if they're keeping their best cards? In this case, if you're flipping it against a 6 reserve plot, then you're only gaining one card on him at the end of the turn. So is that really that good? And then you start to ask these questions. And I think there are situations where it really is, especially when you stack it on with other reserve modifiers. But the last thing that really catches my eye is that we all know from first edition that Winter was tied to choke mechanics, where you prevented your opponent from playing cards. They had less gold, and therefore they had more stuck in their hand. And if in some way Winter does still interact with that, we could potentially see this, you trap 8 or 9 cards in their hand, and then they have to discard a whole bunch of them. So I'm really interested to see what kind of design space Winter takes to see what kind of plot this will be in the long run.
I didn't have this one because I think you're right on the money there, Alex, with as far as what direction Winter takes. We know a little bit about Winter. It seems to have been mentioned in some cards. But right now, I'm just not sure that there's a deck that this actually slots into. So,
I've certainly heard it mentioned as an anti-First Snow Winter plot because everybody's going to have lots of cards in hand. But even then, it only puts you up one card. So I'm not 100% convinced, although at least it lets you play a 4-coster. So maybe. But I think this one still needs the meta to change or to get some support from, say, Winter to really work. But I just find it fascinating from a mechanical standpoint. It makes you ask questions you hadn't asked before.
Yeah, so there have been some Winter plots spoiled from Wolves of the North. One of them is A Time of 4 Wolves that is not really choke. And some of the others seem to be not exactly related to choke. So I don't know if this is going to be the theme for Winter plot. One of them says treat the base initiative value on each revealed plot as if it was 0 that's snowed under.
But there does seem to be an idea of depriving people of things about their plots. Between snowed under, which is stripping your initiative, this, which is stripping your reserve. We may find something that strips your gold. I don't know.
Yeah, not the other ones at least, though. But we'll see.
All right, so for our final round, maybe, I don't know if they're your most exciting picks, give us the Ned.
Okay, so I picked, this was a harder pick, I picked Tobhaw's Mott's Armory. It's a Baratheon 2 gold location. And if you don't know the story, you might think, why is it that when I marshal an armory, I get to draw cards? It doesn't make much sense. Shouldn't I be getting some kind of defense, some kind of armor? And indeed, that's what Tobhaw Mott would have liked you to get if you stopped by his armory. So a Game of Thrones, when Ned Stark, then the Hand of the King, stopped by his armory, he brags about his work and says, you see on the card, any village smith can hammer out a shift of mail. My work is art. But Ned Stark is not there to buy armor. Instead, he's there to do a little bit of research in Mendelian genetics. He's there to meet Gendry. And this is a quote from the book. Ned touched the boy's head, fingering the thick black hair. Look at me, Gendry. The apprentice lifted his face. Ned studied the shape of his jaw, the eyes like blue ice. Yes, he thought, I see it. Go back to your work, lad. I'm sorry to have bothered you. So that's the moment where Ned Stark realizes something very important about King Robert Baratheon. And that's why basically the armory gives you insight, which is draw a card. So I thought it was a very clever kind of Nedly thematic mechanic.
I love that. I hadn't given it that thought at all. And I always find it's much easier to find the Nedley characters, the Nedley plots, the Nedley events, because they're more easily evocative. And in fact, there's a Nedley Nerdly Ned article by Luke who specifically says that, you know, it's so much easier, but we tend not to think about it in the locations because they're just providing gold or whatever it is. But I love what you did there. I'm wholeheartedly behind it.
Yeah, the art, it looks, I like the art a lot, but it does look like a trendy bar in Camden.
Yeah, that looks like a burger joint in San Francisco.
Yeah, the exposed brickwork, the high ceilings and the random scattered objects, yeah.
I like that Gendry was in the same pack as well. It's quite good.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's a nice construction. When like last pack, we had a lot of the knights, and here, you know, at least within Barrow, they've contained that. I think that's neat.
Yeah, that's it for me.
All right. What about your final Stannis card there, Keb?
I've chosen the Arbor.
I was hoping someone would talk about it. Why does Barra hate the Arbor specifically?
I think everyone should hate the Arbor, not just Barra. Plus 3 gold. What were they thinking? That's crazy. It's amazingly crazy. That's just insane. I stared at that card for a good minute and... Well, I think there's some Greyjoy players that probably could be pleased about that, right? Because you can steal it, can't you?
You could indeed steal it with the pillage or hit it with We Do Not Sow, because that's not limited to only non-limited cards. I think this one's worth noting because when I first saw it, my instinct, surprising everyone, I'm sure, is to do the math and think, oh, you know, you're paying 4 for it. It doesn't even pay off on the next turn. It only pays off on the turn after that. And then I realized that's not how you approach this card. You're not wondering about when it pays off. You're saying +3 gold allows you to completely change the way you play. Even that next turn where it still hasn't paid its own cost back, that next turn is a completely different turn from what it would have been. It allows you to use different plots. It allows you so much more versatility. It allows your cost curve to change. You know, the idea of a 5 gold valor is completely different from the idea of a 2 gold valor, even if you haven't gotten your monies back yet. So I think what's weird about this one is that it's a 3 of, and it has to be a 3 of, and it's practically a mulligan condition because you want to see this on turn 0 or 1. It's worth spending a building season just to get it.
Yep.
Yeah, and it works really well with Pleasure Barge. It kind of puts a timer on the game. If you're Tyrell, you often are pretty happy to kind of, you know, play the longer game. And if you play against another deck, you know, you're putting a lot of pressure on them to accelerate what they're doing, because you just get the benefit every turn that comes. It is definitely a card, you know, a location you want to dupe if you can.
I actually have a skill testing question if someone's willing to stand up and let me know. This is the first unique limited card we've seen. Can you dupe a unique limited card on the turn you play it?
I'm going to totally pass on this one. Not going to even try.
No takers?
I would guess yes, because aren't dupes... I know in first ed, dupes were counted as being blank.
Dupes are, in fact, blank in second edition. They're blank at all times when they're in play.
But they have the same title, which is why you can, you know, use Ariane to put one in. So I would probably say no.
And you'd be right. And for the same reason that, for instance, if you have a copy of a character, a unique character in your dead pile and in play.
Yeah, you can't bring it to play.
You can't dupe them either from your hand because you're still... You still have to satisfy the play restrictions, and you cannot play or put into play a card if there's one in your dead pile, and you cannot put into play a second limited card. So it checks that before you even get to the point of determining how it's going to enter play. So you cannot dupe this on the turn you played a limited, and if you do dupe it, it counts as playing a limited, which may surprise somebody, but it's definitely consistent with the uniques in the dead pile ruling. So,
yeah, that would make it much harder to play the Arbor against Greyjoy, especially... if they have that goal lying for We Do Not Sow or anything like that.
Which is somewhat thematic in Nedley too, right? I mean,
yeah, the Greyjoy did definitely go pillage down the Mender.
So is there a specific reason why Barra? I mean, I agree with you. Everybody should be worried about this one. But what is the part about you as Stannis that is really, really bothered by this?
I think the one, like as a personal thing, as me, Stannis Baratheon, I tend to play against Whammur a lot. And his primary house is, as everyone knows, Tyrell. So I'm always keep my eye out for what I'm going to be facing in the next few weeks, and it's just going to be that, isn't it?
Yeah, the jealousy creeping in again, isn't it?
Well, I'm not. If they want to print one of these for Baratheon, I'm not going to advise against it.
I wonder if there's a little bit of the fact that the cards are green and they call back to your first edition Barra 2, so they feel like they ought to be yours.
Maybe. They're calling to me.
Excellent.
Take me.
Yeah, and it is quite thematic that you get the Arbor and Sir Horus in the same chapter pack, because the red wines are from the Arbor, the twins are the sons of Paxter. So it's pretty cool that they came together.
All right, Tom, give us your final Jamie.
Well, this one's not going to be a surprise, and if you hadn't gotten the hint of the theme, I was picking all plots because, you know, there were other cards I shortlisted. I shortlisted Condemned, the Arbor, Red Cloaks, Tobo Mott's Armory, Hodor. Shortlisted all ones we've already talked about, but I went with the plots because, you know, plots have, you know, you can play them when you want. They have extreme power and control over the game, and they either let you do what you want to do or they don't let your opponent do things. So no surprises. First Snow of Winter is the last Jamie card for this pack. It's just going to be a complete game changer at this point in time. You're either going to have to play with it or you're going to have to 100% prepare to play against it. And I think, you know, it's just going to be something ingrained to deck building now for, well, until it probably rotates out or until we get another even better reset.
I mean, First Snow needs almost no introduction at this point. It's been talked about on all the podcasts. There was no doubt in my mind that it was going to be making your Jamie list.
Yep.
It is a hugely impactful card. That said, I do want to put in the caveats because I've seen a lot of people say how the entire game changes. You know, and you're still going to include Chuds in your deck. You're still going to try for good setups. You're still going to do all those things. You're not going to be facing First Snow every single turn. It's Limit Plot Deck 1. And you have to be prepared for it in the same way that you have to be prepared for March to the Wall. It's going to be a very prevalent plot. You have to know that it can come. But that doesn't mean that suddenly everything you know about Thrones is wrong because of this pack. And I just sort of feel like the other casts and reviews have been a little bit hyperbolic about how much it will change the game. I think it's sort of like adding a plot with the impact that March to the Wall has to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I was just going to say, up until coming out, you know, it's been a good period for an introduction to Thrones for a lot of people without these, you know, broad sweeping resets in the game. And I think if anyone's not used to having experienced something like First Snow of Winter, it's going to be a bit of a shock. But that being said, any of us old veterans from First Edition, you know, we're going to adopt a play style and, you know, game states that are now more familiar to us. But yeah, once people get used to having played against it, it'll be fine.
I just really like that it makes, you know, there's this theme about making this really expensive bomb character is important for a lot of decks. And this continues this trend, but it also makes the characters that are 4 or 5 gold much better in some ways. So Palace Spearman or the Unsullied and a few cards that previously were just ended up being cut out of my decks, at least I think, could be given a second consideration now and given a little more space, especially if First Snow of Winter becomes more prevalent.
Definitely agree, yeah.
As a Baratheon player, I'm neither scared of this card nor will I run this card.
I think that's probably the right choice, says Barra. You have the tools to deal with it, but you don't necessarily want to exploit it on a regular basis.
No. In fact, to be honest, a lot of the time, if my opponent plays this, I'll be kind of happy because it means I get to pick up my fiery followers.
Then you can play them again, and if Melisandre is in play, you get to kneel more. Also, Baratheon, if they have Mel and Stannis and Bob out, or 2 out of these 3, they're usually pretty happy against whoever they, you know, ever of the beefy characters they see on the other side of the board.
That's right.
I would tentatively say that Stannis gets weaker in a First Snow meta. He's always kind of a borderline card for me because academically I'm convinced he's a terrible card and I play against him and I realize that maybe academically isn't the right way. But if you're going to have a couple of turns where those low-cost characters get to bounce to hand and get replayed, thus getting at least one extra use out of them, that does weaken Stannis a little.
That's okay.
Well, I honestly think that Barra really wants to play this card when you've got fiery followers, you know, Selyse, all these characters that can be bounced back that keep triggering Mel. And then you've also got like the come into play steal a power little guy. You know, they've got some good come into play effects that things going back to your hand, you don't mind it.
And Vanguard Lancers are, useful.
Yeah, that's the one. Yep.
If you get to trigger
yes. twice.
All right, so that we actually completely we're at the 12th card now, and nobody has picked the same card twice. It's just stellar because my very last card is I feel like it is either like a knowing nod, a wink, or a middle finger to me personally. It's Loot, the Greyjoy card.
Yeah.
Now, if you've listened to this cast for a long time, you may have heard I had a very long rant about how terrible mill effects are in first edition. I've talked a little bit about it in second edition, how a pillage does not change the game state in any meaningful way. It actually generally in this meta gives more information to the person who was pillaged rather than to the person who is doing the pillaging. It's just, it's a terrible, terrible thing. You know, I think it's a badly designed system. I don't think you're milling decks yet. So here I envision Nate going, yeah, you're right. Pillaging itself doesn't do anything, but you know, you've seen Euron. We can make pillage do things, and here's something you didn't think about that's mechanically fascinating that happens to pillage as in, by accident. What this card really does is it takes your opponent's gold to pay for a card effect, which we've never seen in the LCG, and you can take as much of it as possible, so you're basically stripping him of the chance to use Put to the Sword or subsequent Dracarys or whatever. Is that enough to make this card squeeze into a Greyjoy deck? Probably not. But it does mean that, for instance, when you're paying the cost with your opponent's gold, even if they cancel it, they don't get that gold back. So all they're canceling is the mill effect. And if you can throw in a few effects like Euron into your deck, you can get something out of the mill. So I really feel like Nate was listening to my rant about mill, and I said, all right, let's find as many ways to make Alex wrong as possible, and this is one of them. And so I'm quite amused, but also mechanically interested by something we've never seen before.
I think this could be great against Lannister. Because obviously you've got Tywin who gets a strength boost by the amount of gold in your gold pool. You've got Tyrion who's you know, getting you 4 gold potentially per turn. And this guy comes along. Bye.
The trouble is the timing of this. You have to win an unopposed challenge as the attacker, which means that if you're playing first to try and deprive them of any uses, then you've stripped them of their gold, but they'll still get to launch an intrigue, get some gold from Tyrion and use that. So
yeah.
I just don't feel it has the impact to see play. And I may be wrong on that. And maybe as more mill effects happen that actually synergize with the number of cards in the discard pile, you know, cards like Baelor Blacktide from first edition that said your opponent couldn't play events if he had a copy in the discard pile, hugely impactful, might make cards like these matter. But I feel like right now the gold deprivation is really, really cool, but not quite enough. You don't necessarily need that as safety. And if you did need the safety, you'd probably run a Hand's Judgment.
Another mill effect that you might want to consider is the Crone of Vase Dorthrak. So that's kind of a cool, interesting thing that because it works also on mill. So if any one of these cards were a character, you can kneel a Dorthraki character to put that character in the dead pile.
I'd be really interested to see if they could put loot as a keyword, which meant you could use your opponent's gold to pay for it.
Oh.
How cool would that be?
Yes.
That
would be very cool.
Excellent, actually.
That would be very cool.
We'll have to pitch that for the Greyjoy House Box.
Yeah.
Comes around.
But the only last thing I have to say about this card is the art. The chap on the right, his legs look kind of like the devil's lips.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that's the shadow.
What, cloven hooves? Oh, I do see that. I do see that. Yeah, it is the shadow, but it's the shadow forward from the flames in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, the guy on the left looks like he's a skull, but that's just his helmet.
Well, his legs look like the passenger threw some oil on him and said, "Now you shall stand."
This is another Thomas Jedrzejczyk card. He's actually got about 5 cards in this pack.
He had quite a few in the last one, too. We noticed about halfway through our review, we're like, oh, we've talked about every single Thomas Jedrzejczyk card in the pack. Which is good. I like his style, and he does some things that surprise me. So I've enjoyed that. Now, before we wrap up with all the neat cards and stuff, I think we probably all agree that this is an incredibly impactful chapter pack. And I'm wondering if that's deliberate to concentrate some of these hugely impactful cards in one place to give that sort of meta shakeup feeling. And does that timing feel weird because we've got the Stark box just around the corner that would probably have done something similar too? I mean, it does feel disproportionately impactful to me.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree with that.
I just think it's just a, you know, like a bit of a showpiece of the second edition where they know more about what kind of cards are going to make a big difference. You know, there's been a whole lot less, you know, sort of back of the binder cards, you know, in detail. And I don't know if that's just because it's a smaller card pool, but yeah, I really, really like this pack, but most of the packs have been pretty good.
I was really expecting Keb to join in there and say fewer instead of less. You missed out on a Stannis opportunity there.
I'm sorry, I'm a fraud. I'm sort of Stannis light.
Yeah, I want to say I'm very happy as a pretty new player that this pack wasn't one of the first packs to be released, because, you know, I spent more time kind of playing only with the core set on Octagon and whatever, and the chapter pack really messed me up. So every time one comes up, like, my deck really gets destroyed. So I'm pretty happy that there was a little bit of gradual, at least for people who are not as used to adjusting to new cards or don't know these cards from previous edition.
I know that Nate on the cast said that, you know, they tended to put these big disruptive cards either at the beginning or the end of a cycle to get that feeling of changing things all of a sudden, especially since there tends to be a gap between cycles. So I am really wondering if this is not the super impactful chapter pack and the sixth one is, what kind of stuff do we have in that one?
That's a good point.
All right. So that about wraps it up. That's no middle ground. Only two chapter packs to go to this cycle. I have to completely rebuild all my decks right now. Yep. So I guess that's what I'm doing this evening.
Yeah.
Closing comments, John. There are regionals to come next week. I'm excited to see what they're going to do to the annals. I'm excited to see how they're going to have adapted to First Snow Winter.
I'm making a prediction.
You're making a prediction?
Yeah. Lenny, Lord of the Crossing, will win a regional.
Come on. That I was expecting something that isn't obvious.
I like to be right.
This is, you know, and a friend shall lose his friend's hammer and other. It's worth noting that it's not just regionals. There are a couple of really big tournaments coming up in April. Hopefully we'll have a little bit more information about them from organizers over the next couple of weeks. Both of the biggest ones I know of are happening on the same weekend, April 16th and 17th. One is Zaragoza in Spain. They have absolutely phenomenal all dark cards they've been posting. And the Tournoi de la Main in France, also 16th and 17th of April. So if you're anywhere near either of those, definitely check them out. Those are the big events of the April tournament season. Regionals take second fiddle to these amazing large events, as they will be. Tournoi de la Main may eclipse Bataille por el Muro for attendees. Right now they're looking at about 140, so they'd fall just short. But we're talking about a tournament of about that caliber.
Sweet.
And do you have a snappy sign off, John?
I just have more coffee.
Okay, coughing will do.
So no snappy sign off. I'm using my mic at least so that people don't get coughing right into the mic.
Yeah, no one will get a disease from you coughing into the microphone.
It could happen. You have no idea how powerful what I have is.
Some civilizations have been wiped out by unsanitary telephones. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
And the mountain's been to Mars. Go ahead, Alex. Ask me how I know.
How do you know that the mountain has been to Mars?
There's no life on Mars, Alex.
Why do you do this to me, John?
That's my tip of the week. And don't listen to the intro.
It's far too late now, but this could be the Easter egg.
My real tip of the week is don't listen to the intro.